This is the BBC.
Hello, I'm Kirsty Young. Thank you for downloading this podcast of Desert Island Discs from BBC Radio 4. For rights reasons, the music choices are shorter than in the radio broadcast. For more information about the programme, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4. My castaway this week is the cookery writer and restaurateur Yotam Ottolenghi. If there's za'atar spice mix and pomegranate molasses in your kitchen cupboard, then you're already familiar with his reputation as a culinary trendsetter. His dishes, surprise and comfort in equal measure. By mixing the tastes of the Mediterranean Middle East with more staple British ingredients, he has won legions of devotees. His eateries are packed and each new book keenly anticipated. Our current Prime Minister says she prefers his recipes to Delia's. His background is as complex, varied and intriguing as his food. He was born in Jerusalem to a German mother and Italian father. His grandmother was a spy, and he was headed for the life of a first-rate academic when his obsession with the delicious matured from a hobby to a calling. He says when you feed people, you get an instantaneous reaction, a smile, a kind word, a delighted expression. So welcome, Yotam Ottolenghi. Your recipes are notable, not for being complex, actually. They're not technically difficult to make, but they do have often very long lists of ingredients, you know, typically around about anything from 10 to 15 separate ingredients. In your store cupboard, what will we always find if we open it?
Well, you'll find a bunch of spices. There will be cardamom and cinnamon and star anise and cumin and turmeric. And then you'll have other dry stored ingredients like tahini, orange blossom, rose water. You'd find pomegranate molasses, the stuff you kind of mentioned, the staple of the Middle East, but also some Asian ingredients like miso, a couple of sesame oils, mirin. So a bunch of things that really make the food kind of come to life, you know. And for me, having those staples, I'm not trying to prove any point with them. I'm just trying to make the food smile, as I often say. You know, it helps the ingredients or the main things, you know, taste so good.
Now, Buna shimeji mushrooms, don't know if I've said that correctly, Manuri cheese, Kalaspara rice. These are, you know, again, these are things I'm picking out from your recipes. They are not everyday ingredients. They could easily put people off. Do you take personal responsibility for the fact that we are all scattering pomegranate seeds on everything we eat at all times of day and night now? Because you started it, right?
Well, I don't know if I was the first one, but yeah, we do. I do. It's a great device. If you haven't started, then I urge everybody to start using it. It's delicious. It's sweet. It just brings things to life. And you can put it both on savory and sweet dishes. You can put it on your, you know, lamb stew, and it makes it taste and look so much better. So, yeah, I'll take some of that responsibility, if you don't mind.
Let's go to the music then, Yotam Ottolenghi. Tell me about your first one. Why have you chosen this?
This is a song by Joan Baez. My parents, before I was born, they spent quite a few years in America in the 1960s. And my parents have an amazing photo album from their time in the States. And my dad managed to get a photo of Martin Luther King and lots of beautiful places they've been traveling all over, and music as well. So they were listening to Joan Baez and Bob Dylan and all those kind of figures of the 60s. And that symbolizes a big chunk of my childhood.
The highway is for gamblers, better use your sense.
That was Joan Baez and It's All Over Now, Baby Blue. So, Yotam, in your book Jerusalem, there are, I counted, 8 pages, including photographs, devoted to hummus.
Yeah.
Why is that?
Well, Jerusalem was written by myself and one of my business partners, Sami Tamimi. And he's a Palestinian from Jerusalem and I'm a Jew from Jerusalem. And we actually have very similar backgrounds. And hummus was very much part of our childhood. You eat it all the time, you know, breakfast, lunch and dinner. It goes into a pita with lots of other delicious things. It's the food of life, really, in that part of the world.
So tell me about your very earliest culinary memories from Jerusalem.
Well, those are so varied and many. But, you know, I've got it's in Jerusalem when I was growing up, which is the 70s and the 80s, there was this explosion of foods. And all of a sudden, there was all this amazing produce that came from the West Bank and East Jerusalem for the Palestinian side. So you'd go into East Jerusalem to the old city and you'd see wonderful, you know, baklava-style cakes, you know, drenched in syrups and beautiful crumbly cakes. And you'd get these wonderful meze restaurants where you sit down, you get this incredible spread of baba ganoushes and the hummus and the labnes and all those wonderful grilled vegetables and falafel. So you kind of have that kind of richness of ingredients and foods. And that was a very seductive experience for me growing up in Jerusalem.
Is it true that your dad's nickname for you was, is it Golozzo?
Golozzo.
Golozzo. What does Golozzo mean?
Well, I've tried to figure out for many years now, but it's something like a greedy boy or...
I was a greedy boy.
Yeah, I'd love to eat. It sounds terrible now because it's like, why would someone want to be taken to a restaurant at the age of 6 for their birthday? But I wanted to go to restaurants for my birthday. I really had this kind of intense passion and love for food from very early on.
And cooking at home, was it your mother cooking at home or both your mum and dad?
No, both my parents are really, really good cooks. I feel very fortunate to have grown up in a home that I guess my cooking reflects, which is completely kind of mumble jumbo of cuisines. You know, a little bit of my dad's Italian background, actually quite a bit of it. My mom's kind of European background. My mom was very, very adventurous when I was growing up. They brought from America all sorts of cookbooks from around the world. So she would do like Malaysian curries and things that were really in the 70s nobody, you know, had heard of. And still to this day, my parents are great cooks and adventurous cooks. And I feel very fortunate to have experienced all this when I was growing up, as well as this fantastic Palestinian Arabic food that was available throughout my childhood.
Let's have some more music, Yotam Ottolenghi. What is this and why have you chosen it?
Oh, well, it's all about the love of chocolate. And this is from a childhood album called Akeves Ashishasar, or it translates into the 16th sheep. When you can't fall asleep, you count sheep, right? So this is number 16. And it's a compilation of beautiful children's songs by a bunch of really creative, beautiful singers and composers. And the song that I chose called I Knew Her, which means I love, and it starts off by I love chocolate. And that's what I listened to with my son Max when we were driving in the car.
אני אוהב שוקולד ועוגות גבינה וארטיק וסוכריות ותות גינה
אני אוהב את ימי הולדת וסקיות עם דברים טובים ואת השמש ואת הירח וגם כמה כוכבים אני
אוהבת From the album Akeves Ashishasa, that was Ani Ohev. How did I do?
Yeah, you did really, really well, yeah.
Sort of. Tell me a bit then about your paternal grandparents. They were exiled from Tuscany and they built a sort of little Italy in a suburb of Tel Aviv in their home. Just describe that to me.
My parents arrived to Palestine, then Israel now, in 1939, which is, you know, just the year when the war broke. But my grandparents were like metropolitan, you know, Europeans. They were very middle class, relatively wealthy. So they managed to create a little haven, a little Tuscany in Ramat Gan, which is a suburb of Tel Aviv, with a house that even the doorknobs were imported from Italy. I mean, it was down to the tiniest of detail. And my grandparents would have like Italian coffee, a little espressis, Parmesan cheese and anchovy paste in a tube that was being delivered. I mean, it still sparks this memory of going into this house, seeing my grandmother sipping her espresso, making, you know, semolina gnocchi. And it's those kind of evocative smells that are really the smells of a part of my childhood.
Yotam, I mentioned in the introduction that your other grandmother was a spy. I heard a little ripple of laughter from you as I said it, but it is indeed true. She was an Israeli spy.
Yeah, my maternal grandmother, who with my grandfather and my mother and her brother came to Palestine also 1939 from Berlin, from Germany, at some point in her life, I don't know exactly when because it's all shrouded in secrecy, joined the Mossad, which is the Israeli Secret Service. And I think throughout some of the 50s and 60s and 70s, she worked for the Mossad. My mom didn't know about it. She knew she worked for a government agency. She didn't know what she was doing. But in the 1960s, Adolf Eichmann was hijacked in Argentina and brought over, kidnapped, I don't know what the right term is, in Argentina and brought over to Israel for trial. And my mom remembers that one day, one Saturday morning, my grandmother told to my grandfather, he's on the plane, something along those lines. And my mother asked, who's? And she said, oh, some friends coming over from Germany or some relative. A couple of days later, no relatives arrived, but the news broke out that Eichmann was brought to Israel. And my mom, you know, put the two things together. And then she finally realized that her mom was working for the Mossad.
And when did you find out for sure that she played a part in what was one of the pivotal moments of history at the time?
Yes, well, in the 80s, I believe, a book was published by the person who was head of the Mossad at the time, describing in detail the operation. And there was one person who my mom told me was actually my grandmother. She wasn't named. She didn't go to Argentina, but she did a lot of the groundwork back in Israel, false documents, etc.
Let's have some more music, Yotam. Tell me about our next one. It's your third.
This is Paisley Park by Prince. I had all his albums and used to listen to them a lot when I was in secondary school in Jerusalem. And I felt like I was being super, you know, sophisticated for loving Prince. He had sort of that rebellious streak and just he was so cheeky. And I just loved everything about him. I still do, especially this track, Paisley Park.
That was Prince with Paisley Park. And memories for you, Yotam Ottolenghi, of your sophisticated music tastes as they were growing in your teenage years. Your mother, as well as being this adventurous cook, she worked outside the home as well. She was a head teacher, is that right?
Yeah.
And your father was a professor at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem, which accounts for the fact that you would travel around the globe with your family.
Right.
An intellectual family, a middle-class family. What were their expectations for you, their son?
The expectations, smartly enough, were never stated, obviously. I think what was made clear to us three children, was that we would probably become academics or at least go to university and do something with our degrees. And it just wasn't really a question. My mom was a math teacher and a head teacher. My dad was a professor of chemistry, and that was our world.
You completed your master's thesis in 1997, having been at Tel Aviv University. Tell me what the title was of your master's thesis.
I think it was some musings over the ontological status of the photographic image.
And you have a philosophical bent, you have a philosophical way of looking at things. What was the appeal of philosophy to you? Did you feel that getting to the heart of what it means is the important thing?
Yeah, I love understanding things and I love explaining things to myself or to other people. The process of kind of analyzing and reaching a conclusion is very attractive for me. And when I went to university, I felt that's something I really like doing. I love reading something. I love reading a book or a text and discussing it and understanding it fully and giving it a context. And I still love this. When I was studying at university, it was a great opportunity to kind of exercise my intellect. And I really, really enjoy that.
And when you were doing your degree in the beginning of the 90s, I think 1991 was when you moved in with your boyfriend then. That was in Jerusalem, was it, or in Tel Aviv?
In Tel Aviv.
In 1991, in Tel Aviv, to be living with your boyfriend, was that something you could do openly? Was it accepted?
Surprisingly, it was accepted. I mean, in a small bit of Tel Aviv of the 1990s, it felt kind of quite normal.
Did it?
Yeah. The difference between Tel Aviv and Jerusalem is night and day. You know, Jerusalem is a kind of a historical place with a lot of people that are kind of immersed in history and religion and orthodoxy. And Tel Aviv is a more secular, open place that kind of reaches out to the rest of the world. So to move from Jerusalem from Tel Aviv is kind of the same thing to do if you're a young gay adult. You know, it would have been impossible in Jerusalem of the 90s to live out as a gay person.
Let's have some more music, Yotam. We are on your fourth.
Yeah, this is by the Waterboys. And I have an older sister, and I had a younger brother, Iftach, who is 2 years younger than I am. And he was killed in 1992 during his military service. It was a drill, and it was what you would call friendly fire. And Iftach was a very special person in the sense that he was very vivacious. He was a beautiful looking guy, and in secondary school he was kind of the person everybody looked up to because he was melodramatic and dramatic and could act and had everything going for him, lots and lots of, you know, opportunities. But unfortunately he died, and the Waterboys were the band that he liked the most when he was killed. And I chose this song because it is a song about opportunities, and with him it's all missed opportunities. So I thought this would be appropriate.
The river, and this is the sea.
That was the Waterboys with This Is the Sea, and chosen, you said, Yotam Ottolenghi, because it reminds you so much of your brother. It was his favourite band, and he was killed in a military accident when he was doing his military service. You went to Amsterdam in your mid-20s?
Yeah.
Was that related to getting away from the tragedy of what had happened? Or?
This was a few years later, but I guess there was a certain intensity growing around me when I was in my early 20s. And I felt living in Israel, politically, it was becoming a bit more difficult. I mean, there was a moment where it seemed to be going in the right direction, but then it turned the other way very quickly after the assassination of Rabin, the prime minister. And on a more personal note, I think I needed a breath of fresh air at that moment. And my brother has died. I wasn't completely out to my whole family, and it was just I needed time away.
That is almost, it strikes me, and I wonder if I'm right, a more complex thing to be out to certain members of your family and not others.
Yeah, it took me time until I could actually speak to my father. I mean, the difficulty was really after my brother died, I felt a lot of responsibility for his well-being. And my dad is a very gentle person, extremely loving. And I felt that I didn't want to hurt him. And that was very difficult. And I guess it was a little bit easier to be away. But a few years later, I did speak to him, and things end up being patched up quite surprisingly easily because he was very loving, and he was very warm, very happy about it. Not very happy about it, but he was very supportive, and I think I was happily surprised to see that he was absolutely fine.
And you had completed your master's thesis in Amsterdam, and then this very bright young man who'd been on an elite program at a university and was probably headed likely to Yale or somewhere of similar esteem decided that he wasn't going to do that. And instead of a life of the head, he was going to have a life of the hands. You went to train in pastry work, which is, yeah, I mean, hugely demanding, a great discipline and entirely different from pursuing philosophy. Why?
I think I'd never questioned going to university. And although I had a really great time at university and enjoyed working with my head, I always had this kind of inkling to do something which isn't that. And I also found university and academy really exhausting. The job was never done. You know, you would always need to read another paper or write another seminar. And I remember when I did start cooking professionally, and while I was doing Cordon Bleu, I worked in a restaurant in London whipping up egg whites for souffles, quite literally. And when I came back home, I said, wow, this is so refreshing. I've done something that I loved, and I finished. It's done. And I don't work in the kitchen anymore, in a professional kitchen, but to this day, I find being in the kitchen, cooking, the most relaxing thing I could do.
Let's have some more music, Yotam. What are we going to hear now? This is your fifth. Tell me about this.
Arkady Duchin is an Israeli singer of Russian background. And I used to listen to his songs when I was still living in Tel Aviv and Amsterdam. He has the most wonderful voice, a little melancholic, like if you've been listening so far, you'd see that I like. But he's also extremely sentimental. So it's those kind of love songs that I could listen to forever. And also he's slightly marginal because he's a newcomer, because he's got a slight accent. So I always connected to that kind of outsiderness in him. לא יכול להראות אהבה מרוב אהבתך את עצובה, עצובה מרוב שמחתי החיוך נעלם מרוב שמחתך את בוכה, בוכה מרוב הרגלי לחושך לא רואה.
That was Arkady Duchin singing Merov Avati. So tell me, Yotam, you opened your first deli with your partner, Sami Tamimi, your work partner, in 2002 in Notting Hill. What were you serving that was different from what other delis offered at the time?
Sami was in charge of the savoury food, the salads, and I was in charge of the cakes, pastries. And I think we just put this copious generous amounts of food on the table that was just freshly made, really beautifully presented on platters and beautiful plates that we sourced everywhere. And we recreated the kind of the Jerusalem souk effect. You know, it's like piles of beautiful food and people really warmed up to it. You know, people walked in and thought like, oh my God, this is food like in an art gallery, you know, the way you present it. And it was, you know, wonderful vegetable char grill with beautiful sauces and drizzled with sesame seeds, sprinkled with sesame seeds and chopped herbs. I mean, both for Sami and for me, that was the main drive to create this kind of very generous display, you know, with the giant meringues and lots of beautiful, colorful cakes. The idea was that you really kind of create something quite spectacular.
And then after the delis have come more delis and indeed a restaurant and also the books. I wonder how you feel about the fact that your books, they're not translated into Arabic or Hebrew. Does that matter to you?
The first ever book was translated to Hebrew. I don't think it was a massive success. Whether they're popular in Israel and the Arab world, I think it would have been nice if they were. But I assume that it's quite difficult for those markets, for those places to take that kind of partnership of a Jew and a Palestinian working together and kind of bringing their food back to them. I think it's hard to stomach that. An outsider, which is a bit like you, but slightly different because we are different because we're not there bringing all that food back. That's my little theory.
And you do, I understand, meet once a week with a group of friends and you discuss politics over breakfast, a good breakfast, I'm sure. You know, there is still this philosophical and very thoughtful brain inside this head. When it comes to something like Brexit, you know, restaurants and kitchens are typically occupied by a plethora of different nationalities. Yeah. How do you see it affecting your business?
Well, since it hasn't really come to be, I'm not quite sure, but I'm very worried because we are, by essence, a place where these cultures meet. You know, 70 or 80 or however, I don't know how much, with the exact percentage of our employees are not British. And I'm just a bit worried that if we are not going to have that diversity, we're going to lose a lot on the diversity of food that we're exposed to. And for me, as someone who's come here and has been very generously accepted, into this country. And, you know, I've received a massive hug throughout those years with regards to my food and the culture that I bring with me. I think it would be a great loss if other people like me won't be as welcome.
Let's have some more music, Yotam Ottolenghi. We are on your sixth of the morning. Tell me about this choice.
That's Nina Simone, which is probably my favorite artist. I still listen to Nina Simone all the time. And there's something about her voice of fragility, but like inherent optimism that I just love. And she could get away with anything. I mean, she's just marvelous.
Here comes the sun, little darling. Here comes the sun, I say. It's all right. It's all right. Here comes the sun, little darling. Here comes the sun, I say. It's all right.
That was Nina Simone and Here Comes the Sun. It was 2013, your time, when you and your husband, Carl, became parents for the first time. How easy was it for you to decide that you wanted to start a family?
It was easy to decide. It was much more difficult to accomplish. Carl and I went on a real interesting journey, sometimes difficult. At first, we thought as two gay men, we would have to team up with a woman or a couple of women, a kind of a co-parenting arrangement. We tried that for a few years, and for various reasons, it didn't work out. And then we decided we're going to do it ourselves. And we've had first Max and then Flynn through surrogacy. We went to America to do it because it's quite a bit more complicated to do surrogacy here. My childhood memories are just extremely positive, and I just wanted to recreate that for myself and for Carl, to have those children around and muck about and do funny things and listen to music. And that's what we've got now. And one day you want to tear your hair out because we've got two little boys, a one-year-old and a three-year-old, and the next day you're laughing your socks off. So, you know, it's that kind of intensity of emotions that just comes with children.
Tell me about Max then entering the world. Tell me about those moments. Do you remember them clearly?
Yeah. Carl and I were in Massachusetts, where our surrogate lives, and we were there with her in the maternity ward. Labor was about 16 hours, and we were there for the most of the time holding her hands. And after that amount of time, that not-so-beautiful creature came out because he was covered in hair. But he was just the most gorgeous thing that we loved so much. And you know, our surrogate said, we were holding her hands, and then this baby arrives, and we didn't know what to do. She says, guys, what are you doing? Go play with your child. And we did, and it was just the most incredible moment. I'll never forget it. We were there, and he was there.
You've described very articulately and clearly the reasons, the simple reasons, the same reasons as so many people want a family, why you wanted to have children. I'm wondering if there are there any moments when there are strange times and awkward times when people look at you as you know, two guys with children and think, well, I don't agree with that. That's not right. Do you meet those moments at all?
No, I think we're pretty well protected in our central London house, you know, with the environment we live in. We have never had any negative responses. I'm sure those would come at some point. I'm ready for them. I mean, I don't think we've done anything wrong. I think we created the most beautiful environment for our kids, and I think there's only a fool would dare criticize that.
Let's have your next piece of music. It's your seventh.
That's the Smiths, and that's Carl's favorite band. Since I've met Carl in the year 2000, 15, 16 years, he's played the Smiths. And Carl is from Northern Ireland, and it was a massive part of his teenage years growing up in the 80s. And for me, the Smiths is Carl, and I loved them before, but I love them even more now.
All men have secrets, and there is mine, so let it be known. We have been through hell, and I died again. start to recall heavy words are so lightly thrown, but still lightly in front of a flying bullet for you. So what difference does it make?
The Smiths, What Difference Does It Make? That was chosen for your husband, Carl Yotam. Does he cook? Is he a good cook?
Yes, he's a great cook. Actually, he's a better cook, because when I come home, I just kind of get bogged down by all my experiments. But Carl is just a solid cook that makes delicious food, and the kids love his food.
By reputation, you have a huge appetite and you love to eat food. And as a little boy, we know that you love to eat food. And yet you stride in here today looking as fit and as slim as a pin. You're also a qualified Pilates instructor. Where on earth did you find the time to do that?
Well, I used to have standing up in the kitchen. That was in my previous incarnation. I used to, as I said, work many hours standing up in the kitchen. I'm tall and I used to have back problems. And I started doing Pilates to address this. And I just fell in love with this discipline because it really was very effective to dealing with my pain. And at some point I said to myself, well, if my cooking career doesn't quite take off, I might become a Pilates instructor. I do complete things and I want to feel that I've done them properly.
So when we cast your way to this island, what are the first key ingredients for food and drink that you'll be looking for in order to survive?
Well, one of them is my luxury, so I won't reveal that.
Oh, don't
at this
talk
stage.
About that yet.
But what would I look for?
Well, I mean, how are you with coconuts?
I think I'm okay with coconuts, which I imagine every desert island has, and probably a few limes. But I think I'd find it really difficult to start the fire because I'm not that kind of cook. I'm really reliant on my oven and my stove. So I'm not a barbecue kind of chef. So I'd have to struggle a little bit, but I'm sure I'll survive eventually.
Tell me about your eighth. What are we going to hear?
My eighth is by The National. It's a band from Brooklyn that I really, really enjoy listening to at the moment. Often I come back from work and Carl's cooking and the window's open and this is blaring out, so it's the music of the moment in our house.
Turn the light out, say goodnight. No thinking for a little while. Listen, I'm trying to figure out everything at once. It's hard to keep track of you.
That was The National with Fake Empire. Yotam, it is time for me to give you the books. We give all of our castaways the complete works of Shakespeare and the Bible or another religious text. Would you like the Bible or would you prefer the Torah?
I can have both. Because
no, you can't.
No.
Can't start that with you. They'll all be at it.
I guess I'll have to take the Torah.
Right, so that's yours. So, and what will your additional book be?
The additional book would be A Suitable Boy by Vikram Seth. First of all, it's a very long book, which is very useful. But it's also a fantastic book about family, which seems to be a theme in my life. And it's complex, it's emotional, it's a journey. And I think I could spend many hours enjoying that family aspect vicariously via this story.
It's yours then. And now I think it's going to be a culinary luxury from what you were saying. Tell me what your luxury is.
So I'm going to take a lemon tree, and I need lemons so much that I'd rather just, you know, give up any other luxury for that. And over the years, I've kind of developed 100 ways of dealing with lemons, from pickling them to roasting them to just juicing them. And I think a lemon is one of those magic ingredients that really kind of livens up a dish.
We will give you that constantly fruiting lemon tree then for your island. And if you had to pick just one of these eight discs, which one would you want?
I think it would have to be Nina Simone, just because I love her so much.
It's yours, Yotam Ottolenghi. Thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island discs.
Thank you. It was such a pleasure.
You've been listening to a download from the BBC. You'll find more information on the Radio 4 website, bbc.co.uk/radio4.
This is the BBC.